Hi everyone, Alex Feeney here from FC Cymru, bringing you this latest Red Wall podcast. And in this edition, we're talking to the big guy. No, not Ryan Giggs or Brian Flynn. We're talking to the manager at newly crowned JD Cymru Premier Champions, Connors Key Nomads. It is, of course, the shy, retiring wallflower that is Andy Morrison. Lots of great chat here about his playing days, starting at Plymouth at the age of 17, winning the title, mental health and football life, managing in Wales's top flight, the lot. And if you're thinking, yeah, I know, I saw the whole video online, then hold your horses. Well done for watching that, but we've added a little something extra into this just for all you podcast fiends. But before we go any further, I need a cheeky favour. If you like this podcast, and there is simply no reason you wouldn't, we would be utterly grateful if you were to show some love by giving it a 5-star rating on your podcast provider so that other like-minded Welsh football fans can join in. And while you're there, why not click or tap subscribe to get these fabulous episodes piped straight to you without you having to lift a finger or cost you a bean? Brazen appeal over, back to chat. Now, obviously, to coax Andy's timid yet charming personality out into the open, it would take someone with great patience, sensitivity, intellect, and guile. So we asked FC Cymru's Abby Davis if she knew someone who could fit the bill, but she didn't.
So Andy, first of all, how does it feel for me to be welcoming you as the manager of the Champions of Wales?
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's great. You know, a lot of hard work, and it's nice to have that title. You know, it's thoroughly deserved. We worked incredibly hard. We were in an incredibly strong position when the season finished, or when it was curtailed early. And it's just nice, you know, because like I say, I think you know yourself, the work that goes on behind the scenes is huge, by so many different people. And you know, and I think it's just a reward for a lot of hard work for not just this season, for a good few seasons now.
Absolutely. You've definitely been knocking on the door for a few years, I think. And I think everyone in Wales can say, everyone that follows Welsh football is just so delighted to have another club up there that, you know, can take on that for Wales. And we are very, very proud as a nation, I think, of what you've achieved this season. We are going to come back to Welsh football because I'm quite interested to know your thoughts as well on, you know, how it's developed since you've been at Nomads. But we're going to start, we can't have you on and not discuss your playing career, first of all, because I think you could say that was quite successful in itself. You obviously made your Plymouth debut at just 17 years old. I just want to, you know, it seemed, when you look back at it, it seems quite a seamless transition into professional football. But what was it really like? Were there any early setbacks for you?
I don't, I went to Southampton, but was, I don't think I was emotionally or mature enough really for that at that time. I think I was maybe 13. And it was such an eye-opener, and so done professionally, everything that was there. I was in the same group as Alan Shearer and the Wallace brothers, Matt Letizia, and it was just a, you know, but it was what I needed at that point in my career. I needed to see the sacrifices. I needed to see the dedication that was needed. I went back and then obviously went into Plymouth as an apprentice and supported Plymouth from the time I arrived in Plymouth at 8 years old. So I had a real strong connection with the club. And obviously came through apprenticeship into being a professional and played many times with the club and had a fantastic period down in Plymouth before I moved on.
And how did that time at Plymouth shape you? You know, what had you brought from Southampton and how did it shape you as a player? Were you always, you know, the loudest in the dressing room? Were you always destined to be a captain and a leader, or was that something that came a bit later on?
I think when I go back as early as sort of 10 years old, I was a captain of Plymouth Schoolboys and captain of Devon Schoolboys. And it was just the personality, really, and the character that I was. You know, I was loud. I was demanding, even as a youngster. So, you know, I every club I went to, eventually, you know, I captained the club in some form. So I guess it was there, those traits from a very, very early age. You know, and an ingrained desire to win. And I think that's infectious, no matter what age you are. If people see that, you're willing to go the extra length, how hard you want to work. I think people follow that, you know, and I just think it's probably the natural qualities of a captain.
Were there times, both on and off the pitch, where maybe you felt that people expected you to need to prove yourself as a player?
I was always, I mean, my validation really came from my father. You know, it was his seeking approval, acknowledgement that I was doing well. Even when I played for Plymouth, you know, I'd walk into the players' bar at the end of a game and I'd look at him to see, you know, and if he was looking away from me, I would have thought I'd had a poor game. And if he was looking straight at me and with a glint in his eye, then I'd know I'd done well. And I think it's a healthy thing to have a respect, you know, for whoever your mentor is, whoever that role is, you know. And for me, it was my father, you know. And I remember driving back from Southampton as a 13-year-old, and I never spoke all the way back when I was told I wasn't being taken on, you know. And I think it was like a 4.5-hour journey. I never said a word, just sat in the back, just felt like I let my dad down, you know. And I just think that's the characteristics of somebody who's determined and wants to succeed, you know. And that kind of followed me everywhere. You know, even in my early days at Plymouth, I was a professional footballer and I was playing in the first team, but I was still up at 3 o'clock in the morning landing fish with my brothers on the fishing boat. And then I'd go into training at 9 o'clock. So, you know, my dad always kept me really grounded. And, you know, it's in my book, one story where we played Brighton away and we were leaving at 8 o'clock. And I'd been landing the fish at 3:30 in the morning. And I'm going back to the flat to go to the game, and I've got no key to get in the flat. So I've ended up having to go to the ground in my wellies and my oilskins. And I had to get some training kit from the kit manager before the manager came in, who would then seen that I'm obviously been working in the night. So it was quite an adventurous young period for me, do you know, where until I'd actually established myself and my father knew that I was had a career in football, I always had to be working at the same time on the boat.
I think that's so important, you know, to command that respect. And I think many people could argue that's one thing that football maybe lacks now, because there are so many easier routes into playing football. But that hard graft is something that really sets you up, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I was actually having this conversation last week with somebody about the, you know, I think the characteristics of a good competitive man, a winner, I don't think that ever changes. You know, we have fashions, we have trends where things come in and go out. And, you know, I always think there's a lack of urgency from youngsters today. You know, they're not as anxious to do well, you know, but the qualities are still there. And yes, I think that adversity and that toughness, I don't think it's as evident nowadays as it was in my day, and probably a lot before me as well. But I still believe if it's in your heart to be a footballer or whatever profession, the profession you're going into, if that's your dream and that's your desire and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then, you know, I think those qualities are the same right across the board.
Definitely. And then, obviously, from Plymouth, you then went to Blackburn and played under Kenny Dalglish. I'm quite interested to know, how difficult a time was that for you? Because you only made 5 appearances, didn't you, there? Mm-hmm. How difficult was that for you, going from, you're in the first team at Plymouth and then going to making just 5 appearances in the season? What was that like for you mentally as much as anything?
Really, it was really, really tough. And not only was I going into a squad that was on the up with players at that time who were very good but went on to become great players, Colin Hendry, Henning Berg, David May, you know, Ian Pearce, who had a fantastic Premier League career, and Patrick Anderson, who went from Blackburn to Barcelona. So these were all centre-halves, and, you know, on reflection, and it's easy in hindsight, you know, it was the wrong decision. I also compounded it with a knee injury. I went to Blackburn with a knee injury. I managed to kind of blag my way through the medical and I played a game or two, but then the knee was too, so I needed to get a knee operation. So that set me back sort of 4 months. So it was really December, you know, before I began to train right to get myself fit. And then an opportunity came. I played in the first team, did really, really well. And we beat Wimbledon 3-0. I had an exceptional game. Played in the midweek game in the cup, and then David May's suspension was up, and David came back and went into the team at Tottenham on the Saturday, and that was just, that's the way it was, you know. And you know, obviously David May went on to play for United, Henning Berg went on to United, Colin Hendry had the career he had. So, you know, on reflection, there was 3 or 4 other options, you know, Leeds, Wolves, Luton, at the time had all made bids and offers. And, you know, I think the lure of Blackburn and Kenny Dalglish and the players they were, it was just too much for me. And I've been met him and spoke with him. But, you know, I think with the right kind of guidance at that time, I would have carried on playing. And I wouldn't have played anyway, obviously, because I need the knee operation. So that would have held me back anyway. But, you know, to carry on playing another 30, 35 games the following season would have been what I needed at that time, not to, you know, not to go into that sort of environment where the quality of the players were immense and they went on to win the title the year after. So, you know, it was a step too much for me.
What do you tell yourself when you're in that position? You've obviously played well enough when you've been given the opportunity, and then you're still dropped when a player comes back from suspension. What do you tell yourself to keep yourself motivated at that point?
I think your desire to keep working hard, keep wanting to prove people wrong. I think if that happens to you on two or three occasions, then I think you're getting the message then, really, it's time to move on and you'll have to look elsewhere. But, you know, it was the first time it had happened to me, so you know, get your head down, work doubly hard in training, keep improving. You can't help but improve when you're training with good players, and wait for your next opportunity to come along. And they were very sporadic, you know, the games that I played. It was, I had so many good players ahead of me. And eventually, you know, it came to a point where, the obvious thing was to move on.
And of course, you moved on. You were actually the club record signing, weren't you, for Blackpool under Sam Allardyce. And I think he described you as a horrible, in-your-face kind of centre-back and a complete nutter, is the quote. So, yeah, how would you say that's accurate?
I would. Would I? At that time, 100%. Yeah, I can't argue with that at all. I've been called a lot worse as well, so that's not too bad. And I was actually on the way down to Swindon.
Right.
I was going down with Steve McMahon, was the manager there, and I was going down to sign for them. I got a phone call, and Blackpool had offered more. I turned around on the M6 and headed straight to Blackpool and sat down with the football director, which was Billy Bingham, and Sam, and signed there and then. You know, Sam told me everything I wanted to know. I wasn't somebody that had to be sold a club, you know, or persuaded. I was either in or I wasn't. And, you know, once I knew they wanted me, once they made it obvious that I was in their plans and how they were going to, that's enough for me. You know, I didn't need to be persuaded. I didn't need to be shown the new plans for the new stadium and everything. You know, that's just the way I am. I'm either in or I'm out. It's as simple as that.
And I think that mentality as well stems from being a hard worker. You don't want it for the luxury lifestyle or things like that. You just want to do it for the benefit of playing football.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've always been, you know, I've always had such a passion for football from such a young age. You know, it kind of saved me really when I was directionless in my life, and it gave me something to focus on. And it's what I've always loved doing. And it's never a job, it's never a chore, you know, it's a pleasure and a privilege to be involved in the game. So I think you're very, very fortunate if you have a love for something and it becomes your profession, then, you know, you're doubly rewarded. So it was always that way. You know, if you don't want me and they do, I'm all in. You know, it's as simple as that. And that's how it was at Blackpool. And I had a fantastic period there. I only played about 60 games. But like I said many times, you know, I'm in the Hall of Fame there, so which I'm incredibly proud of. You know, it's alongside sort of Stanley Matthews and Jimmy Armfield and players, you know, who everyone knows, and to be mentioned in the same breath as them means, again, I did something and I left an impression at Blackpool.
Definitely. And what was your relationship like with Big Sam? You know, for him to describe you using those words, I think I'd say anyway, you need to have a good rapport with a person. Did you have that with him?
I did, yeah, I did. I mean, you know, Sam goes a little bit more into depth in his book and talks about somebody that perhaps struggled a little bit away from the game. But when I trained, you know, I trained like it was my last training session. I played every game like it was my last game, and it was like a cup final. The intensity that I did, everything football-wise, you know, and Sam understood that and saw it. And away from that, you know, my extracurricular kind of behaviour wasn't great. And it, like I say, it's been well publicised on many occasions. I don't ever shy away from it. It's quite tough sometimes when you're sort of 21 years since you last had a drink, and then you talk about it and people tend to think you're talking about yesterday, which is a little bit, you know, I find that a little bit awkward. But, you know, like I say, I've never shied away from it. It's it was part of my career, you know, my character pushed me and created somebody that wanted to win. But on the flip side of it, it also destroyed, you know, my career in many ways. So, you know, kind of like the same demons that drove me to want to be the best when they weren't channeled in the right direction, they were very destructive.
I think we often say that I have quite a lot of mental health chats with people. I'm an ambassador for quite a few mental health charities. And it's always the thing, your mental health can be the thing that drives you to be the best, but it can also be the thing that destructs you. And I think that's something that's common with all of us that have issues like that. It's, you know, it can be the same thing that drives you to want to be the best footballer, to be the most successful and have these ambitions, but that can also be the thing that drives you to destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I had this conversation with somebody a couple of weeks ago, and you know, I it's somebody who I respect a lot, and I actually asked that question, you know, is the same demons that, you know, have that do destroy you, and you know, you've seen many people commit suicide, and is it the same demons that can push you to climb mountains and achieve things that are almost impossible? And it was, the answer was yes, it is, you know, but finding some sort of peace with them demons is the answer, you know, eventually to for acceptance and channeling them in the right direction. And also making sure that when they do start talking to you, that they're your friend and not your enemy.
Yeah. And what was the environment like back then for something like that? Because I actually spoke to Andy Robinson, who used to play for the Swans, last week about what the environment was like for him with a mental health condition when he played. What was it like in terms of support back when you were at Blackpool? Was there any way you could talk about that, or was it something you just had to deal with in private, kind of?
I think on reflection, I think when you look back, you actually see the darkness, you see the fear, you see those moments, the chronic anxiety and the circling thoughts in the head now. But at that time, you didn't. And it wasn't that you were in denial. There was just no acceptance whatsoever. It's absolute nonsense. So I'm not even going to go there. I'm not even going to mention it to the physio doctor or nothing. I'm just going to cover it up, put the front on, build the walls and just get on with it. And so, like I said, even if I'd sat down with somebody and spoke with them at that period, I would have, there's no way I could have accepted or even acknowledged that I had something that was maybe slightly fragile about me. There was, you know, and again, it wasn't denial. There was just no acceptance whatsoever. And, you know, we've come a hell of a long way since the mid-90s and in our understanding of things, and there is obviously avenues now for people to speak to, but most of the people who were affected like I was would only look back now and think, wow, God, if I'd only known then, if I'd only been able to speak to somebody. But you know, it is, everyone's journey is different, and thankfully nowadays there are so many avenues for people to pick up a phone, go to their doctor, speak to somebody within a football club and just say, I'm struggling, you know, I'm really struggling at this moment in time. And then being able to get an avenue, because it was, like I said, I don't even think it was seen as a weakness, because there was no acknowledgement then. You just wouldn't go there.
Yeah, it's the awareness, isn't it? I always say, even 5-10 years ago, I wouldn't have openly said, I hear voices in my head. I would never have done that. But now I think people are at a position where they're willing to understand it. Whereas before, I think people were quite willfully ignorant. If I say that now, people are more likely to want to understand how that's the case, or you know, they won't laugh, because 5-10 years ago, the perception would have been completely different if I'd gone, yeah, I hear voices in my head. But now people understand it a bit more, and that empathy is there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And like I say, with so much more education, you know, and there's the lack of ignorance now is great. And like I say, I think the key is educating people, you know, and having an understanding. And that's right from the first minute you walk into football. You, as a 16, 17-year-old, you know, you're offered avenues, you're offered places you can go if you are struggling.
And what, just out of interest, is there anything that you do with your players at Nomads? You know, is there anywhere they can go? I'm sure having someone like you as a mentor, you know, that helps in itself. But is there anything there that they can do if they're struggling?
I think it's a pretty open book. I'd like to think that, you know, with my own acceptance and not acknowledgement, really, of where I've been. And I openly speak to the players on many occasions. I've said before games or during coming up to big games, you know, about fear. You know, it's not courage is not the absence of fear. You know, courage is actually having them thoughts, those negative, continual, universal thoughts that go around in our head. But being able to see them and then being able to talk to them, or even come and speak to somebody else. You know, I've spoken openly about it on many occasions, and I think the players, and I have had those conversations with players, you know, because there are times when I can look at a player and just see there's something different, just his mannerisms, his body language, it's just not right. And again, that's good, you know, to be able to see that and be able to speak with a player. And you don't always, you know, get an open, honest answer, but it gives you the opportunity in that conversation to just say, if, you know, if there's anything you need to speak about, I'm here, Jay's there, Craig, if you want to speak to anyone, you know. And I think it's important to know that there's that avenue, and it's not judged in any way.
Mental health in football is a really big thing at the moment, and it's great that people like Andy are using their own experiences to help others and to encourage players to talk about their feelings. The FAW Trust has a program called We Wear the Same Shirt, which delivers a comprehensive football training program for people suffering from mental health issues and provides a nationwide campaign to combat the stigma against mental health. Sessions are held by clubs across Wales in Newport, Cardiff, Rhondda, Newtown, Haverford West, and Wrexham. If you'd like to find out more about We Wear the Same Shirt, then please visit fawtrust.cymru and find Mental Health Football in the grassroots section of the website. Back to Andy then, and Abby picks up the chat with the next chapter of his playing career, the Manchester City years.
He went from Blackpool to Huddersfield before, yep, obviously going to Man City, which is very well documented. They even sent you a message of congratulations, I believe, when you became champions of Wales. But you quickly established yourself again in that squad, and you played a really pivotal role in getting them to where they are now. I think that's fair to say. Is that one of your proudest achievements?
Yes, it is. You know, because where I was in my career at that time, and the mistakes I'd made along the way, and the mistakes were still being made when I first went to Manchester City. But, you know, as I've said, you know, I put the drink down in February, I think, 99, and haven't drank since, you know, and very quickly after that, you know, we obviously 4 months down the line, 5 months, we're promoted, we're in into the Championship, and we get promoted again. So, you know, life was very rewarding for me for the sacrifices that I'd made at that time. And still now, you know, I think the club acknowledge, the fans especially, they acknowledge the period that they were in, because you've got to remember that the team across the road were doing the treble at the same time. So it was a very difficult time and a period of time to be a Manchester City fan. But the loyalty was incredible. You know, we were sold out every week. The passion that the fans had still for their football club, although it was struggling, was huge in the second division. They stuck with the club, and then you look where we are today. And you know, and I always say, I think it's just reward for the loyalty and what they showed at those really, really tough times, because they were tough, and they deserve everything they're getting at this moment in time.
But I think you're still regarded, aren't you, as one of their greatest captains? And I think everything you've just described about the fans, their loyalty, their passion, are things that you demonstrate on the pitch.
Yeah, I think we had a bunch of players, you know, if I think back, you know, Richard Echo was born, you know, in as a City fan, and came through the academy, and, you know, there was other players there that had come through the academy. There was good players who had come into the club. There was senior players. So the timing was right for me at that moment in my career. You know, so many, such a good manager, good coaches, good players, and just lacking something. You know, there was just something slightly missing, and maybe I was that little piece in the jigsaw that they needed at that time to bring it together. And as they say, you know, the fans now, you know, I still work at the club as an ambassador on match days, and I still represent the club on functions when I'm asked to do so. I'm very lucky in that area, considering where the club are now and the history they've had over the sort of the last decade. It's been remarkable. But there's still a warmth for that squad and that team, who turned, you know, which was a huge ship in Manchester City, which was going in the wrong direction, to turn it around and then do back-to-back promotions was remarkable. And the manager is loved by the fans, and the players from that period as well are always held in great esteem.
Definitely. And I was going to say, you know, you show that passion. And I remember there was a game, this is just completely off the track, but there was a game at Cardiff Metz Ground a few seasons ago when I first started working for them. And you told Chris Wilder to get in the wall. And I just turned to the person next to me and said, if Andy Morrison told me to get in the wall, I'd actually get in a brick wall for him. Because you just have that. If you say something, you listen.
Yes. You know, that's nice of you to say. I think the players know me, and I think people who know me away from football would probably say a slightly different character. But on match days and training days, you know, it's my life, and I can't sugar tint anything. You know, people have to understand the importance of every small detail. And I think your voice, I think your body language and your eyes let other people around you know the importance, because there has been times where I haven't quite had that same intensity, and the players will definitely pick up on it, and they will drop off 10% if they feel that I'm not in the same zone as they are. So I'm very fortunate. I've got a fantastic group of lads, and thankfully they know me in football and out of football.
Well, you nearly had a very different group of lads before you joined Connors-Key Nomads. In 2010 you were announced as the manager of the Seychelles national team, and we can't, as soon as I read about that fact, we couldn't just ignore it. So what do you remember about that? Obviously it wasn't you, but what do you remember about that time?
Well, it was a phone call I got from a paper, from the National, I think it was a Daily Mail, just saying, was I aware of this? The story sort of came from over in that area of the world, and then it kind of grew a little bit, and then I was being asked if I was the manager. I think it was Seychelles, and I remember joking at the time, I won't deny it, I'll see how successful he is, and if he does well, I'll stick it on my CV. And it was somebody just apparently claiming to be me, used my kind of like history of football in my career to get the job, and got it as well. So fair play to him.
But luckily it didn't affect you, because he didn't last very long at all there, because I think they realised quite quickly that he wasn't you and he wasn't the man for the job. So at least it didn't impact your career.
No, it didn't. It didn't. It would have been a nice little stint though, wouldn't it, going across there for a few months.
And then obviously you joined Connors-Key Nomads. I'm just interested to know, did you know much about the Welsh League before you joined? Because there is kind of still, as much as we all try to work to eradicate it, I think there is still that stigma sometimes about the Welsh Leagues, which is completely nonsensical. But that is still, what were you told about the league before you joined?
Well, when I originally came with Andy Priest to Airbus, I'll be honest, I didn't know. I was fixated on the football in the Northwest, the non-league scene. So I didn't know very, very, very little about the Welsh League. We saw an opportunity, we spoke with Airbus, and they had ambitions and plans and where they wanted to go. And we took the job. You know, it was a lot more secure than we were in at the time. We were at Northwich and we were doing great. Again, we'd had a fantastic cup run the year before, beat Charlton in the first round of the cup. And we were pushing for a promotion with Chester to get out of the league. So the success was already there. But, you know, the club folded very soon afterwards. So, you know, we made the right decision. Airbus was a great opportunity. We managed to bring a lot of the players across that were playing for us at that time. And, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, we absolutely ripped it up for 3 years. You know, we were miles away from TNS. We were nowhere near them. But the next best thing was to come second. And, you know, we went from a team that were always in the bottom three or four, had never beaten a top six team, to finishing second in the league in our first full season. and the next two seasons as well. So we had three back-to-back European campaigns. And then it really became my time to move on. You know, I knew what I brought to the table. I knew what part I played in that success. And I always believed I could carry on and do it, you know, as leading the ship rather than being an assistant. And the Connors Keys job came along. The timing again was right, as you always need in life. You need things to fall right for you. You need an element of good fortune and luck. There was a lot of very good players, an ambitious chairman, a club that knew where they wanted to go. And, you know, when I got the opportunity, got the interview and got the job. And we kicked on from there, and we've done very, very well since. And there was a lot of good things in place, though, when I came in. You know, it was, yes, they were bottom of the league. Everyone knows that. But, you know, when you've got George Horan and Paul Linwood and Les Davis, you know, Jamie Crowther, there's some exceptional players there. So I just needed to give them a bit of guidance, add a little bit more intensity in all areas of the club. And, you know, we kicked on from there, and we haven't never looked back since.
And how much has not just Connors Keys Nomads, but the Welsh League developed since you've been at the Nomads? How much have you seen, you know, the interest in the game improve? I think we see, you know, different outlets are now covering it. They're all interested in Welsh football. How much has that changed since you've been there?
I think it's the standard has improved year on year. I always go back to, I think the quality of the managers and the coaches, I think, is exceptional. You know, through the Welsh Trust normally, the coaching education area of Wales is phenomenal, as good as anything in the world. And we've all done our pro license, and you know, there's incredibly bright, young, forward-thinking managers and senior managers who have had a you know, decades of success. And so I believe that maybe the players and the budgets and all that maybe aren't on a par with some of the conference or even to the Conference North. But I believe the coaching, I think the management, and I think the technical side of things is way, way ahead of the rest of it. And it has improved. You know, the playing, the surfaces, obviously, with the 3Gs, which aren't always my cup of tea, but, you know, they allow you to play in all kinds of weather, and they give you a surface that is neutral for everyone. And the gates have improved. You know, it is a hard sell. I understand how difficult that is. You know, with football just continually thrown down your throat from all angles, you know, on a Saturday afternoon or a Friday evening to go and watch your local team when it's a bit cold and fresh, and maybe Manchester United are on the television that evening or the next day there's a couple of games. It really is difficult in that area to sell football. But I think what we did last season, I think, plays a huge part in it being progressive, because, as I've always said, if there's no competition, there is no interest at whatever level of football. It dies away. And with ourselves now challenging, you know, Val have obviously made, again, some great signings. Barry looks as if they're getting stronger. There's other clubs that are forward-thinking. I think the competition is great now. It's certainly improved. And, you know, everything's come a bit closer together now. So it gives a general interest to people. You know, if they're doing really well down at Carmarthen or Barry and Connors Keys are coming, there's got to be a competitive edge for anyone to have an interest in it. And I believe it's probably that's the big change for me is now it's closer. All the teams now have a chance of pushing for the top six. And especially now, maybe four or five clubs have a chance of winning the league.
And I think that's one of the most important things with you winning the league this season is, you know, I can be wearing my Cardiff Mets shirt and people will ask me what division they play in. And then the answer will always be, oh, that's the one TNS win every year. And that's always been the way it is. And it's so infuriating. But that's just, you know, that's just the way the league has been perceived for many, many years. So what you've done is going to change the perception of Welsh football, I think, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you go to Scotland, then obviously people will know of TNS, but they'll also know Connors Keys now.
Yeah.
With us reaching the you know, the Scottish Challenge Cup final and then obviously beating Kilmarnock last year. You know, everyone up there now who has an interest in football knows Connors Keys. They know they play in the Welsh League. And, you know, those results echo across the whole pyramid, really, when our result is like that and how well we've done. And TNS have had some good results in Europe as well. And it just reflects good for the league, you know, that a Welsh Premier League team are able to go and beat a top Scottish Premier League team. It just speaks great volumes for the league and shows how far we've come. And I think, as you said, you know, it's so important that there is other names and other people. You know, if you look at the history of Barry over the years, and Banger have had great periods. And it's so important for me that your Bangers and your Reels get back into that top Welsh Premier League, because these are huge clubs. You know, you look at what Carnarvon have brought. And I always, every time I go to Carmarthen down there, I always think, you know, that could be such a hotbed of football. And there's such a, you know, because they're crying out for a team that would go and lead and push on in the Welsh Premier League. And these top teams have to be back in the league eventually, you know, and for me, they can't come quick enough. We put massive demands on the players, you know, and expectations. And they've bought into it. You know, last year, you know, we've seen the improvements in not just physically, but also mentally in the players that have come into the full-time programme. They bought into it and understand the sacrifices and the lengths that you have to go to. There is no shortcuts to success. And if it is successful, it won't be longevity. You know, the success comes from hard work, continually working hard. Also working sensibly as well. You know, it's not just about touring up and down the land. And, you know, you've got to find a structured way to use your time right. And we think we have. We've got the balance right. And, you know, and I expect those players to kick on again this year. I really do. I expect to see a big improvement in our younger players that played last year. I think they can kick on now for the next three or four seasons, because we've got a good group who are between sort of 21 and 24. We've got senior players as well who are just a credit to the football club. So right across the board, you know, I think we're in a really healthy position.
Definitely. And do you think that maybe clubs in the English pyramid could utilise the Welsh Premier League more, or the Cymru Premier even more than they do? You see players like Ben Cabango coming from Swansea, going to TNS. Do you think more could use it as a system to improve their plays? Because like you said, the coaching's fantastic. The standard of football is great. Are you surprised that not more clubs use it?
Well, I don't think we're there to benefit any other team. Yeah. You know, we're there in our own right. And, you know, we're not looking for any favours off any other clubs. You know, if a young player comes into the Welsh Premier League, he has to be very good. It's very difficult for young centre-halves, I think, or even young strikers to come in, because they haven't really learnt their trade. You know, they've not been beat up. They've not been dominated and bullied. So, you know, I've seen centre-halves come in and they come up against a Les Davis, or in the past, the Reece Griffiths, and you know, they look very, very average because they don't understand the game. So, yes, I think you know, there's an avenue for teams to sort of bed their players in and understand the game, but it's certainly not them doing us a favour. It's more the Welsh League doing them a favour by allowing players to see what it means on a match day to lose a game of football, and the, you know, and the disaster that comes with that, because, you know, it's an internal sort of like investigation within the club. If we drop points, we have to look at it and see why, you know. And I think when they've been in academies, maybe they don't feel that each week, you know, but when it's your life and it's your, you know, it's your livelihood, it's a great learning curve for young players.
And just, you know, you mentioned Bala have signed some great players, which they have, but you've signed Aaron Edwards as well, which I think is the signing of the summer myself. You must be incredibly happy to have him on board.
Yeah, he's a player I've respected for many, many seasons. You know, I made a comment a couple of seasons ago during the game to him, and he rammed it down my throat by flicking the ball around the corner and then banging in the top corner from 30 yards out, and then let me know, like, you know. So this is somebody I've always respected, somebody who is a ferocious competitor, wants to win. Every single game I've seen him play, he plays like it's his last game and his most important game. And we're delighted to get him on board. You know, we did everything we could. We told him how important it was, you know, for us going forward, that he'd be part of our group. You know, we also brought in Craig Curran, you know, who was at Dundee last year, and he cemented down for the season. You know, Jamie Insull, And, you know, we've got some really, really good players. And we've got a very good, healthy balance to the squad. And, you know, we're champing at the bit to get back training and playing because, you know, the uncertainty still at the moment makes it so difficult. You know, yes, it was great that the season was finished when it was and it was the right decision to be made. But I was also mindful at that point of where are we going with this? You know, when are we going to get back? When is football going to look like it did, you know, back sort of January, February before all this kicked in? You know, when is that? And at the moment, we're still not clear and, you know, we're heading towards July.
And just finally on that, you know, how do you look at your European prep even? You know, how do you even plan that? Because remember last season, Cardiff Met were back in training in June. So, you know, how do you even prepare for that at the moment?
The only preparation we can have is a template in place of a 6-week training program heading towards that first game in Europe. You know, I think if we get that 6 weeks, whenever that comes, whether it's August, middle of July, or heaven help us, September, at least we'll be able to plan. You know, the players are monitored. You know, we have their weights every single week now, so we know that nobody's putting weights on. They're bright boys anyway, and I think the world has changed as we spoke about earlier on. You know, I think these lads are so much more aware of their own fitness levels. You know, when they do just go for a run, you know, they're more likely to have a protein shake in their hand these days than have a pint at the weekends. You know, which is great. It's great, and you know, so we know they're looking after themselves. The weights are right. You know, I speak to them at least twice a week, every player. And as long as we can get that sort of 6-week program that we know we can start from day one and build in slowly, integrate the training, and then obviously bring some games in, and then hopefully we're ready to go in that first game. Well, not hopefully, we will be ready to go in that first game in Europe when it comes along.
Now, if you'd been watching the video of this chat, then this is where it ends, leaving you slightly mournful, melancholy even, that those magical moments ended all too soon. But because you are listening to the podcast version, we've got a little treat for you. An extra 3 minutes and 28 seconds of more Morrison talking about the best player he ever played against, how to stop a player like Lee Trundle, and this.
Who is the best manager you've worked under?
I'd have to say Joe Royal. At Manchester City, obviously, the success that came, you know, back-to-back promotions, and the way he carried himself, you know, I learned so much from him, and he was an incredibly good man away, not just in football, away from football.
And who's the hardest opponent you've ever defended against?
Very easy, that one. Peter Rundlove. I don't know, probably before your time, was at Coventry. Was an exceptional front player who absolutely tore me to shreds when I played for Blackburn in a live game on Sky, and probably ended my career at Blackburn on the back of that performance. So I've never got a chance to play against him since to get my own back, and so I've had to carry on and live with it, the torture he gave me on a Friday evening.
And how would you deal with, obviously you're doing this with Lee Trundle, how would you deal with a player like Truns with the shoulder rolls, the magic daps, how would you have defended against that?
Well, you're probably alluding to the goal he scored against Kamara then, are you, in the cup? Well, let's break it down. First of all, the period before he received the ball, the back four should have squeezed. So he should have been in an offside position, but they didn't move quick enough. Once he's received the ball, it's obvious he's going to turn onto his left side. So I would have shut that side off. When he took his first touch, if he'd gone past me, I would have just took him out and got a yellow card. So that would probably be the way to stop Lee. But when I've watched the goal back, it's all about the back four not moving out. When you've got a player of his quality and you can get a ball into his feet, then you've got a problem. You must stop the space and the ability to get a ball into him. And that comes from hard work on the training ground. So we won't get too deep and tactical on it. But basically, if all else had failed, I would have just failed him.
There's one. If you need any motivation when you get back into training, you could just remember that, because I think it's still quite fresh in your memory by the sounds of it. If you could have had any centre-back partner, who would it have been and why?
Centre-back partner. When I went to City, I played with Jared Vikens, a Dutch defender who was exceptional. He was a perfect sort of Philip for me, really. You know, he was clever. He read the game. Every time I stepped in to attack Nathan, he was always in the right position, and was the perfect foil, really, for an out-and-out header and an aggressive centre-half. So it would be Jared Beacons.
And just finally, how important has the Cymru Premier been for your career?
It's been everything. You know, everything. I can't ever speak too highly of it. You know, the platform that it's given me, the people within the league, you know, the ability and the opportunity to show what I can do, and also great coverage, you know, from Scorio, and it's been a fantastic opportunity. But I have taken that opportunity. You know, not everybody takes it. It was you know, I was given a chance, and I can never ever speak too highly of the league and what it's actually gave me so far, and long may it continue.
And that was the Thinking Man's Alex McLeish, Andy Morrison, manager of Connorskey Nomads, talking to FC Cymru's Abby Davis. Our thanks to Andy for setting aside his natural reserve. And if you're thinking, I wonder what that chat looked like with pictures and stuff, then you're in luck, because the video is available for your viewjoyment on the FAW's YouTube and Facebook pages, along with lots of other cracking bits of content, including a wonderful look at the future of the women's game in Wales and a glorious trip down memory lane to France, 2016, and that marvellous film by Johnny Owen, Don't Take Me Home. Some really lovely insight and behind-the-scenes stuff from Johnny and others there that you still haven't heard, even 4 years later, so please do check them out. Those episodes have also been turned into Red Wall podcasts as well on this very channel. So if you've stumbled across this episode, be sure to take a listen to our previous editions, including an amazing chat with former Wales manager Chris Coleman, the Dreamboat. And while you're there, just a gentle nudge to please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating if you're feeling in the mood. On the next edition of the Red Wall podcast, we'll be talking to Evergreen Magic Daps Lee Trundle about his playing career and why he thinks the Welsh Football League is massively underrated. Here's a little teaser.
At the start, I was playing in the conference at the time for Southport. So coming to the Welsh League, I didn't, for myself personally, I seen it as, you know, was I lessening my chance of becoming a professional footballer? Because I thought if you're doing it at Southport, at that level, you're going to have more of a chance to go in, and with the English setup as well. And I do think that's still the same with the Welsh League. I think the Welsh League is overlooked. I think it's overlooked for the players that are in it. I think it's overlooked for the managers that are in it. And that's just the sort of stigma that it has, where if you go and play in it and see what, you know, see the league itself, you realise that the standard is very good. So I was probably a bit naive to that thinking I was taking a big step down. But my agent at the time said, listen, come on, let's go, give it a go. I think it'll be good for you at the time. You know, with you had Goal, it was called at the time, where they showed the goals on the TV and you had your highlights. So, you know, I went along, and fair play to my agent. It was a great move for me, because I enjoyed every minute of playing there.
And if you fancy a bit more of that, then stay across the FAW social media channel so you don't miss out. That's it for this edition of the Red Wall podcast, though. We'll catch you next time.